Mr. Gemara says about the fact that there are liars and that we're lucky for the liars, and that's something that saves us from sinning. Right? The language of the Gemara is that here in Samachas Samad Aleph, we should go write thank you cards to all the liars. Were it not for them, and then the Gemara goes on to say, So, this is an interesting discussion over here. So, we're talking now about the role of honesty, both in the collecting of staka for yourself and in the collecting of staka for others. It's just this idea that we're saved from sin because of the presence of the liars. So, that's a point that we did discuss the first day, and we'll come back to that for our chazara. But there was an interesting tshuva, which I just saw referenced today, and I looked up on HebrewBooks.org, where the tshuva is available. It's in tshuva Sabir Yaakov, Simon Mem Zayin. It has a lengthy tshuva about what exactly is this Gemara talking about. You know, essentially, that is it talking about somebody who wants to give tzedakah and just isn't sure who is worthy? So why should he be grateful? Here, this person wants his chutz, he wants to be able to provide staka to be helpful, and he's held back from doing that because people are lying. So you don't think that that's really something that he's going to be too grateful for. He's losing out on his chus that he's really seeking to obtain because people are dishonest. That's hard to imagine that would be in the category of bold and nafsik tov. And if we're talking about somebody who really doesn't want to give staka and is just blaming it on the liars, so we don't have a way of knowing what you're thinking, but that's between you and God. So what difference does it make whether you use a fake excuse or not? And take it further, if we're really talking about his bad intent that he's blaming on this, and we're saying that's the sin, so that's a sin b'machshava, and to what extent are we going to really hold you liable for sins b'machshava? Normally our policy is not to do that, except for avodah zarah. So this tshuva has a whole back and forth about this, and he concludes in a quite a fascinating fashion, says that this sin that the Gemara is talking about is not about the sin of not giving tzedakah, and that's its own problem. Somebody who doesn't give tzedakah when he can, so that's its own issue. The issue here is the next line of the Gemara that we just read together with it, the idea of kol ha'mayim einav minat tzedakah, ki ovid avodas kochavim. But essentially, so this is a separate concept, that somebody who hides his eyes from tzedakah is compared to an avodas kochavim. So since we have the concept that by avodah zarah is something that we hold you liable for, even machshava, that's what the Gemara is talking about. That the Gemara is not talking about refusing tzedakah per se in the situation where somebody is chayiv, but in hiding your eyes from the aniyim. Now what exactly that means is not clear, because it sounds like he's assuming in the tshuva that you actually are giving staka, but at the same time you are still concealing yourself from the needs of the aniyim. That there's something that's addressed there, even when you're actually giving them staka, but you're not fully addressing their needs, and that's idolatrous in comparison. But you're saved from that avera because not everyone is honest in the first place. So you don't know who's honest and who isn't, so therefore you're not actually held liable for this. Very complicated concept. The question is perhaps a little bit more understandable than the answer, but it's worth taking a look at if you have a moment. Again, it's available on HebrewBooks.org. It's Shulis Adir Yaakov Simon Mem Zayin. He also discusses there that it seems like the Avera is intensified by this Rekara Alech Al Hashem, that the idea that the Ani is going to cry out, that's something which creates a bigger avera on your part, not just failing to support him, but causing him to cry out to God. And that's what the Gemara is also including in the etzem ha'avera. One might think, perhaps, it's not what he says, but maybe the avera that's addressed there is also the chil Hashem. You know, the idea that the Aniyim should feel like the Jewish community doesn't take care of them, and therefore they have to call out to God for help because of the insensitivity of people around them, that maybe that itself is a Chil Hashem, it's so to speak, they're calling out to God and saying, God, how come you haven't successfully got your followers to follow the obligation of the tzedakah? So perhaps that's the idea, it's a Chil Hashem, and it's a disconnect from God's commandment in general, and that's what the Gemara identifies as Avodah Zarah. It's an interesting question to think about what exactly is the full impact of this Gemara, and what exactly is the full focus of this Gemara. In any event, so we had discussed the question of dishonesty among the collectors, whether they're collecting for themselves or collecting from others, and we saw that even though we do allow pressure for tzedakah to some extent, but that there are some limits and we don't seem to allow overt dishonesty or even less overt dishonesty. So we saw that we could identify a few different levels in which one might be dishonest, and each one, for the most part, we're finding is not acceptable. Right? So if somebody claims to be an ani and isn't really an ani, so that's clearly a problem. If somebody collects for tzedakah, but tells people he's collecting for a different tzedakah, even though it is a tzedakah, so we found that the poskim also, pretty much across the board, found that to be a problem too. If you are collecting for a tzedakah, and you tell people which tzedakah it is, but you create the impression that it's more popular than it is, that more people are giving to it, so the poskim, such as the Tshuvas Minchas Yitzchak, noted that that's also a problem, because the Gemara in Masechet Sukkah had this statement about those who caused major problems for the Jewish people. One of them, one of the categories was poskei tzedakah b'rabim, these people who make these public announcements of how much tzedakah they're going to give, and they don't really have any intention to actually give that tzedakah. And their motive is not necessarily to impress anyone. Their motive is to get other people to give to the tzedakah, make it look like a cause that people are paying attention to, and nonetheless, that's not acceptable. Nonetheless, that's considered to be a problem for the community. On the other hand, we saw that there is a Gemara in the beginning of Erechin, which suggested that Rav Yanai did something positive for the Aniyim by making it look like the pile was smaller, and therefore motivating people to give more. And we discussed possible approaches. We mentioned how the Beis Yosef asks, that was what he's trying to do, why didn't he just say it straight out? And suggests in one answer that he wasn't willing to say it straight out. That much was too dishonest for him, but to create the impression he was willing to do. And we suggested, really, the answer we thought was maybe the best resolution, is that the level of dishonesty is radically different. Here you're not pretending someone's an ani when they're on, nor are you pretending that the cause is a more attractive cause, nor are we pretending that the cause that is identified is more popular. You're simply highlighting the need, and that need is generally there. It's just that people tell themselves it's not so necessary when they see a huge pile in the tzedakah box. So by taking that huge pile away, you're kind of leveling the playing field, and presumably that's why it's okay. So there is also another interesting mucker about this. This is a Yerushalmi in the end of the Masechet Peah. It says that Rav Zecharia was the topic of a lot of discussion, that there were people who spread rumors about him that even though he was collecting tzedakah, that he didn't really need it. It wasn't necessary for him. And then when he died, they accessed his records, and they found that all the money he was collecting, he was giving out to other aniyim. So essentially, he was a good collector, so he didn't actually need tzedakah, but he used his collecting skills to get a lot of people to give tzedakah. And then the tzedakah that he had, he gave out to actual aniyim. So what do you think of that? So is that deceptive? Is that acceptable? Is that a raya for anything else?
That would be kind of both everything else.
Seems like we would comparable to Erechin, if for nothing else, the fact that it seems to be endorsed by the Gemara. So if you want to team it with stories that the Gemara seems to be siding with, so for that reason alone, it would seem to be comparable to Erechin, but
Well, I was just more so, it would be comparable in the sense that there's always a need of tzedakah, because people don't realize it. Mm-hmm. And Zecharia had this talent that he could get that money from people, so was might be comparable.
Yeah, it might be. So it seems like, again, you know, to have both those things going for it, that, that conceptually it seems to be comparable, and it seems to also have the endorsement of the Talmud Yerushalmi. Is Super Schnorr still around in Sharon?
I think so.
So he's still, so I remember when I was there, so there was a man named Super Schnorr. So my first instinct was that that seemed like really an operator, you know, somebody who's even known for his tremendous snoring capacity. Then I was told by several people that he collects all day and he supports a whole bunch of Aniyim. He has a lot of Aniyim who are living in his apartment or whatever it is, and he supports them all through his collections. And I make him more of a priority, recognizing that, okay, some people are good at this and they're also able to be mechalikim to other people. He, if you meet him, he also has a special skill that, again, assuming he's still the same level of kofas as he was when I remember, but he has this perfect memory. So, right, you're talking about the same guy, so he'll see you in the morning. Right, let's say he'll see you in the morning, he'll get something from you, and then in the afternoon he'll see you with all your friends and say, stalker, got from you ready, stalker, and he keeps perfect track. So, okay, so some people are very good at this, and they actually are helping a lot of people, so if that's, that was the Shmuel then, hopefully that's the case. So, if that's the story of Reb Zecharia, so it seems like there's more legitimacy there. So, Yitzchak Zilberstein has a discussion where he says that he asked his brother-in-law, Reb Chaim Kanievsky, about what can be derived from that case, and essentially he asked the stira between the Gemara in Sukkah about poskei Sukkah Barabbim and this Yerushalmi vow to Zecharia, and Reb Chaim Kanievsky said, essentially like Morty said, that here he really was giving it to Tzedakah, and he said a little bit more, that really Zecharia really did need the Tzedakah. He needed the tzedakah in order to give it out to the aniyim who he was fronting for. So it's not like he was collecting tzedakah under false premises. He's collecting tzedakah for aniyim, which he was then giving out to aniyim who happened just not to be him. So it's an interesting distinction to make. The shaila that Zilberstein has, which prompts him to bring this discussion, I think would seem to be a pretty good example of something that shouldn't be justified under the guidelines that we're talking about. He was talking about a situation where you have people who basically have a lottery, a raffle, whatever you call it, and they donate to tzedakah, and they get lottery tickets by donating, and whoever wins gets half the pile. So they generate a lot of contributions through getting people to participate in this raffle, and then half of it goes to the winner, and I guess the other half goes to tzedakah. So you purchase a card by donating to tzedakah, and the card gets thrown into the pile, and that makes the pile that they take from. So the shaila was, could you throw in fake cards into the pile so it'll look like more people have been involved? Sorry?
That's like counterintuitive for a lottery.
Right, so it's counterintuitive in a couple of ways. So it's the opposite of Rabbi Yonah. Here you're trying to make more people, might look like more people involved in tzedakah. So you could say that, well, when we said a few minutes ago that you can't be posting tzedakah barabbim to make the cause look more popular, maybe we could be mechalik between causes. You know, it's one thing, let's say, which is an interesting question to ask also, maybe it's one thing I'm raising for a certain specific tzedakah, so there's no problem if I make this tzedakah look like it's the tzedakah that everyone gives to, when really it isn't. But let's say it's an objectively prioritized tzedakah, it's a public kupa. So if I make it look like everyone's doing what they should be and donating to it, so is there anything wrong with that? Maybe yes, maybe no. But in this situation, it seems like it's worse because basically you're selling lottery tickets and you're trying to sell them based on creating the impression that the pot is big and that it's worth more. So it seems like that's really straight out fraudulent as far as how you're getting people to participate. So it's hard to see why that should be mutter. In any event, he certainly concludes that it's not mutter, but it doesn't necessarily focus on that problem. It just focuses on what exactly is the resolution between the different makaros, and notes along those lines. Hi.
Sometimes in business, in business halacha, there's a dispensation when there's a common business practice that everyone does, even if it might be deceptive in a certain way, everyone realizes that this is what everyone does. So does that exist in in tzedakah as well.
Well, assuming that that's actually the case, I'd say two things. First of all, we don't know that's even the case there, that everyone would assume that. And in general, what I tell the business students, as far as that distinction, is I think there's a distinction you made on that level as well. That when you're actively trying to create a false impression, so the fact that everyone else also does that is not justified. That type of logic, that is the common practice to do things, is therefore where people understand that this is what it actually means, that this is what the actual representation is, because this is how everyone phrases a certain set. So then, okay, that will define how people will interpret it. If you're actually trying to cause a false impression, people, so that it doesn't seem to be justified by the fact that everyone else is doing it. And within that also, when we talk about Gnevus Das, so it's a thin line to be drawn, but it's a significant line, that let's say, for example, you're going to sell your house. Right? So before you sell your house, so you paint it, you fix it up a little bit, so it should be in good shape, so it should be an attractive house for people to buy. So there's a difference between doing that in the way that you're putting your best foot forward, because everyone expects that you're putting your best foot forward when you're selling something, and they understand that whatever they're seeing is the best version of what it is, and it's not the average version of what it is, on the one hand, and on the other hand, where you're actively trying to create the impression that it's something that it isn't. You're painting the house so it'll look much younger than it actually is, because you want people to think that it was built far more recently than it actually was, so then that's really deceptive. So there is a distinction between actively trying to create a false impression and putting your best foot forward, where that's more susceptible to common practice, and everyone understands that when you're selling something, when you're coming for an interview and the like, they expect you to put your best foot forward, and they understand that, okay, they're not seeing the average day, they're seeing your best possible day. So within that kind of range, whatever the common practice is, has a lot to establish what the baseline is. But if you're really trying to create a false impression, things become a lot more problematic. Okay, so all of that is some general background as far as this is concerned. But I left you with a question last time. I don't know if you thought about the question. I'll restate the question. So as we see from the Gemara and Sukkah, that to claim that you're donating to a certain cause so that more people will donate to the cause does not seem to be justified. And that's the better case. If you're doing it so people will respect you and they'll think that you donate tzedakah when you don't, then that's overt, the neighbor's das, and that's even worse, and that has even less of a justified motive. But what would you say about the following? This is a question we left off with last week. So let's say, I was asked this question nice, or was told by after the fact. So let's say somebody, I have a charitable organization where they always publicize who their big donors are, and they have the categories, the platinum donors, and the gold donors, and the silver donors, and the builders, and the constructors, and the uplifters, and the supporters, and the friends, and the buddies, and the pals, and however they have the different categories. So you have somebody who normally makes very big contributions, and he's in the mega wonderful category at the top of the page. And this year, they're not doing so well. They've had a business downturn, and they don't want people to know about it, so they ask you a favor. The past 10 years, I've been in the mega wonderful column. This year, put me in there again. I'm not going to be giving this year, but hopefully next year I'll be back. But for now, I want you to keep me in this category. Now, you're motivated to do this as the stock organization for a couple of reasons. First of all, again, it is better for you to have people think that people are giving, but we saw already that's not necessarily a justifiable motive. That's probably in the category of post-gate stock of the rabbin. But it's also beneficial to you to keep a good relationship with this donor and to fulfill their request at this time. So what do you think? Is that a legitimate thing to do? Is that mutter? What are your thoughts about that? Anyone have any thoughts about that? Yes,
I don't know if this is going to play into it, but I just want to bring up another angle, possible angle. So I understand how it could be embarrassing for him, but on the other hand, if people were to look in this, I guess, and see that he's giving the same amount of tzedakah as he has in the past, that could be a gauge of how much money he has compared to previous years. So people might go up to him, and besides for the tzedakah that he's giving for the shul or whatever, they could go up to him and ask for the same amount of money that they would have in previous years.
and therefore it's good
or bad.
And
he might not have the money to do that.
Right, so you're saying it's against his interest to do that because he's going to get hit by everybody else.
Different angle.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
that could be true, but let's say, no, this is what he wants. So, can you go along with this? Sammy?
One possible thing to think about is, I think I was realized when we were doing this, I guess, on the Dafeng Suvis, that if this person is,
which,
like...
Which side? What?
That I think from the Gemara's that we did earlier in Suvis, we saw some of the stories. It seems that if this person is, like, pretty confident that next year he's going to be able to fulfill that highest level of donation, then seemingly this might be okay to do just for 1 year if he misses it. But if he really is something like that, then it may take a while.
Just to interrupt you, are you saying that he'll pay back for this year also?
No, just that he's
okay.
Just that he's going to be able to give that big donation in the future. Then maybe like to miss a year is okay. But if he is under a lot of financial pressure and that he does, he's not 100% confident that is true, that at some point, person, even with the Dei Machzor rules that we have and everything, you saw that maybe someone who is falling down, I guess, in their social status has to, like, maybe not all at once, but slowly has to kind of downgrade himself to get back into where he is in society.
Interesting point to focus on. Okay. I could have thought that maybe from Dei Machzor you could have seen some evidence in the other direction, but I hear what you're saying.
Or do something like, you know, downgrading him one level of from gold to silver, and then see what happens from there. And then, because at some point, like the guy in the Gemara who died because he ate the bed, I forgot what it was.
He was too mafuna.
Lentils, yeah, because he didn't realize where he was.
Now, it's interesting because the Dei Machzor of Sugyas could probably yield some evidence in both directions. Which I guess we'll see as we chazer. I was first thinking of a idea to glean from there in the other direction, but your point is, we'll take us the idea. What do you want to say about that?
If what we said about Rachim is the allowance for deception is if there was already a need there, so I guess it would depend on the organization, right? If it already has a legitimate priority in the community, then maybe keeping him on allows for a deception that would just help people, oh, there's a wealthy person on this list, I want to donate also, and so it would just increase the people giving, which is an allowable deception.
Maybe, except that we see that in Erickson, he made the pile look smaller, which seems to be okay, while assuming that that's the way that you explain that Gemara, others explain the Gemara differently, but the way we were explaining it is that making the pile look smaller, all that does is highlights the nature of the need, which really is there. It's just a question of how people feel the urgency. While if you make a cause look more popular, it sounds like from the Gemara and Sukkah, like that's a problem. So in this case, it seems closer to the Gemara and Sukkah, like you're making the cause look more popular. So I think from those perspectives, those are the counterpoints, that on the one hand, normally making a cause look more popular is a problem, and normally allowing somebody to claim credit for stuff that they're not giving is a problem for other reasons as well. So in this case, those are the downside arguments, those are the negative arguments. However, it could be mitigated that, first of all, let's say you have a lot of names, so it's not going to be a significant different impression whether this person's name is on the list or not. So the cause is not going to really be represented any differently in a significant way, because there's one more gold donor when there already are a few. Let's stipulate like that. Who knows if that's really what you see is. And you have a person who has been giving stuck at a high rate for a number of years, so one could argue, theoretically, that it's not really Gnevas Das to say that they're doing something this year when they actually have done it the past 10 years. So then that's not really creating a false impression of their generosity. They actually are generous, and they've established that when they're able to do it, they do it. And right now, it's an interesting point to make. One could really argue that they have established that when they're able to do it, they do it. So now, if they were able to do it, they also would do it. They're just not able to do it. So one could make the case that they deserve the goodwill that is created by that impression because they've actually earned it through their previous behavior. That's one possible angle to illustrate. But here also, we've seen that the desire to conceal the fact that you had a financial downfall is one that our Gemara seems to support. And according to some Rishonim, that's the main purpose of De Machzara. Right? We saw some Rishonim who say that that is either a element or the element of De Machzara, is to help somebody who has been in a better financial place from being exposed as someone who's had a financial downfall. So if you put all those parts together, it seems like, depending on how you evaluate the different elements, there may be grounds for a lenient position here, because the motivation to help this person not be exposed as having had a financial decline is one that the halacha seems to endorse. And the Gnevus Das components might be limited for two reasons. One, if the cause is already significantly supported by a lot of other people. And two, this individual, you could argue, is not getting false goodwill. It's goodwill that they've earned, and goodwill that you could even argue they deserve this year, because they've displayed through their past behavior that if they were in the same position they've been in the past, they would have given the money to this cause. And so maybe that's an argument that could be made. We mentioned the last semester, and maybe this is what Sandy was also alluding to, we talked about Lashanas from the Hashalom Sugyas, that there was a tshuva, and the tshuvas Shevet Akahasi, a contemporary sefer of Hashalos and Tshuvas, that discussed, are you allowed, which we I think mentioned this semester also, because it's relevant to our Gemara here, that if you tell a staka recipient that the money is not staka, you're in charge of a fund to give out money to poor Talmidei Chachamim. And you tell this Talmid Chacham that the money is not from staka, it's a gift from you to him. So should that be mutter? So Shevet Akahasi assumed that, yeah, it's mutter, because we have a principle of mutter l'shanos b'fnei Hashalom, that if your motivation is to keep the peace, that you can stretch the truth. And Gnevus Das, he says, like you'd be getting false credit here for this gift. That's Gnevus Das. So Gnevus Das is a subset of Sheker. If you're allowed to do Sheker for Shalom, so you could do Gnevus Das also. So I think we mentioned a time that it's not so pashut. There are those who disagree that Gnevus Das is Muslim with Neha Shalom. But presumably it is a question of how you add up the various factors here. So you could say in this case the Gnevus Das is minimal. And the Shalom consideration, so to speak, we find that there is a endorsement from the halachic system to help somebody avoid the embarrassment of being revealed as somebody who has had financial hardships. Okay, any further thoughts about that? Okay. So there is another approach, which I think we alluded to the other day, that says that the difference between Rav Yanai and the other Gemara is the times when you're allowed to use some kind of deception or not has to do with if it's a case of kfiya. If there's a situation where you're allowed to compel to give the tzedakah, so then this is a form of compulsion, that essentially getting somebody to do what he has to do, even if it's through making him have a false impression, that's part of the methodology of kfiya. So that does bring us full circle, because that's really where we started this Zman, so it brings us right into our Chazara. So the idea of Kfiya Vitzdaka, which is an idea that we find the Gemara alludes to on Daf Memtes, prompting the Rishonim over there to discuss it, that we have a concept of Kfiya Vitzdaka, that Staka can sometimes be compelled. So to bring us back to our first day, if you recall that we said we're devoting this Zman to topics of the communal responsibilities of Maseches Ksuvos. Now, Ksuvos is about the level of obligations people have towards each other, and that on one hand it talks about the spousal obligations, the obligation of a husband to his wife, and vice versa. But as we know, that relationship is really a microcosm of the relationship of society in general. The Gemara says in Kiddushin that V'ahav Florecha Kamocha is the reason why you have to love your wife, but clearly it's also the reason why you have to love everyone else also. So it highlights the idea that the relationship with the spouse is an intense version of the relationship you have with the community as a whole, and it's a model for how you behave towards the community as a whole. So throughout Maseches Ksuvos, we have not only a focus on that, but also a focus on our relationships in a broader sense. So we mentioned that we'll be talking about sugyas of kfiya a little bit this month. So after our midterm, we'll talk about kfiya in the context of gittin, in the context of other mitzvot, but specifically gittin. And you started off noting that there seems to be a concept of kfiya by tzedakah as well. And we mentioned that the question is asked, so how could you have kfiya by tzedakah? The Rishonim ask this, and the Rishonim ask it for different reasons than we might otherwise ask it. So we discussed at the time reasons why we might find this difficult without knowing any contradictory sources. Now, we might say that it's hard to believe that tzedakah should work with kfiya, if you recall different suggestions the Talmidim had. So among the issues were, first of all, if there is a rachmanis component in tzedakah, so how could you force someone else to express rachmanis? That doesn't seem like it's much of a kiyum hamitzvah. We talked about that last week in terms of the reyes that's supposed to come from shalach manis and matanis levyonim. So is that going to work if it's being forced, if you have kfiya involved? We talked about the question of how do we actually know what people are really capable of? Are there practical issues with kfiya and tzedakah? Does it counteract, does it contradict the fundamental attitude that tzedakah is supposed to represent? So we brought up various conceptual questions that we had with the concept of kfiya, but the Rishonim asked a more technical question, that the Gemara has the idea that kol mitzvah saseh shemotav zchare b'tzida, that if you have a mitzvah that the Torah tells us what its reward is, so then normally that's not subject to kfiya. So if you recall, Tosfos asked this question on Mentes and Beis, one of our first Mar Mekomos, Tosfos Yirmaskul Akfiya, Akfiya Rava. So there the Gemara says, Vim Tomar Hech Kafa Oso Bishvil Tzedakah, how could you have kfiya for tzedakah? V'haksiv matan zchari b'tzidah, d'chsiv l'man yivarechecha. So that's the question from a technical perspective that the Rishonim asked, that how can you have kfiya by tzedakah if it's technically excluded from that category because it's matan zchar b'tzidah. So we find that the Rishonim have a couple of different answers. Right? So what answers did we find? So one answer that Tosfos gives here, and that some other Rishonim have, is that tzedakah should not be viewed as a mitzvah saseh solely, but it also has low saseis. On the one hand, the Pesukim and Parshas Re'eh tell us you have to open up your hands to give tzedakah, but on the other hand, it also says that you should not clench your fists or harden your heart. So therefore, you also have lavin. You also have prohibitions. Now, it's worth thinking, we won't spend so much time in general on the sugya of kfiya b'tzedakah, one could spend a lot of time on the various makoros in the interest of time. We're not going to do that, so we'll just talk about it a little bit quickly. But one could say, and one could pay attention to what this means, that if you assume that, in general, mitzvah saseh, it might be reasonable to be kofa, it might be reasonable to compel. So, if it's a case where matan zchar b'tzidah, where the Torah tells us its reward, so that removes it from the kfiya category. So then you can say, alright, so then what do we care if there's also low saseis involved? We've already seen that this is not a mitzvah that has kfiya. So you have to say, just broadly speaking, that the mitzvah's low saseh redefines the mitzvah and redefines what kind of kfiya we're talking about. And that's what perhaps these Rishonim are alluding to. That's one angle to consider. Another angle to consider is, as some other Rishonim point out, that maybe when we're talking about tzedakah, so our interest in compelling it is not because of the mitzvah angle. It's not because we're interested in providing some zchus, some schar to the one who gives, but it's because of the communal necessity. That essentially, if we can establish with enough certainty that this person has a chi of tzedakah to the tzibur, so we're saying essentially that this is their money that he has. This is a shibud. And if this is a shibud, so we could justifiably compel based on that, not because we're motivated by the schar mitzvah of the individual, but we're motivated by the needs of the recipient. Parenthetically, you may recall, we also discussed a little bit earlier on, it's also a question Post can talk about, that if we acknowledge kfiya by tzedakah, do we extend that kfiya also to the kedimas of tzedakah? Let's say you have somebody who is giving tzedakah, but he's not giving tzedakah based on the priorities that we have discussed over a course of a couple of shiurim here. So should we say that we force him not only to give tzedakah in the first place, but to direct his tzedakah specifically to the aniyim who he has to prioritize? You may recall we also discussed an interesting shaila that we said that the individual donor has to prioritize his relatives, while the public kupa must not prioritize anyone's relatives. But what would you say if you have a wealthy person who's not giving tzedakah, and he has poor relatives, and the kupa is kofa from him, collects tzedakah from him against his will? So now that they've taken his money, should we say that he has to? They should prioritize his relatives, that maybe the money, so to speak, is due to them, and therefore maybe it's legitimate for the kupa to prioritize this person's relatives because they are essentially performing his responsibility for him. So that's also a topic of machlokas. The topic has to do a little bit with how this whole process of kfiya works. So you have some who say that the kfiya is because the losa says, some who say that the kfiya is because of the shigud ben adam l'chaveru. There are some who say that it's specific to the type of neder that we have. The Torah says, motzis vasecha tishmor, that when you make a commitment, so then that creates a higher level of obligation. And when it comes to tzedakah, even if you didn't actually make the commitment, but because the commitment is considered to be self-evident, so maybe the kfiya comes from that angle, which is another possible solution. And others, like the Meiri, and really like Tosfos over here also says, it's interesting, this, the answer isn't Tosfos, but nobody pays attention to it because everyone's interested in the other part of the sentence, where Tosfos tells us about the two lavin. So before Tosfos says it, there's a two-word answer that we don't pay so much attention to, that it's talking about kfiya b'dvarim, that maybe we're saying that there is real bezdin kfiya, and Nechanami, that does not get involved when it comes to tzedakah. When we talk about tzedakah, bezdin does not really be kofa, but when it comes to kfiya for tzedakah, we're talking about verbal kfiya, meaning that you're allowed to pressure the person, which is a part of what we're talking about on our daf. We asked how can we have a different standard for tzedakah than for other things, that if I would pressure you to share your donuts with me, so that would be avak gezel, right, that I can't put you in a position where you're socially uncomfortable if you don't share your donuts with me. But when it comes to tzedakah, we can do that. So if it's gezel, so gezel's not allowed for tzedakah. So it seems to be that this is a reflection of what these Rishonim were saying, that there is legitimate kfiya for tzedakah, and kfiya b'dvarim is the way we do that. So to put the person in an uncomfortable position, when the chiyuv is clear, so perhaps that's justifiable under the heading of kfiya b'dvarim.
Hi. But there's a different kfiya that exists?
There is, theoretically. The Bezdin has a more physical type of kfiya, which exists by other mitzvot, and many Rishonim feel it exists by tzedakah too. But some of the Rishonim are saying maybe it doesn't exist by tzedakah, maybe because tzedakah is excluded from kfiya for other reasons, so maybe if we talk about kfiya by tzedakah, we're only talking about the verbal kfiya. So that was a debate among the Rishonim, and the Poskim generally assume that active kfiya is involved when it comes to tzedakah, but at the same time, we don't see it nowadays. Even though the Poskim write that it does apply theoretically nowadays, but it doesn't apply practically nowadays, because we don't have the functioning bezin that's able to do this. So we simply don't have a structure in society where we could pull it off, so it conceptually applies, but it doesn't apply practically. Now, if you say, like the Rishonim, that it's a kfiya b'dvarim, so we do find a certain legitimacy for kfiya b'dvarim in the contemporary context, and that perhaps is what indeed continues to be practiced ad yom hazeh, and therefore isn't a problem of avak gezel or the like. And we saw, as Rav Ozner writes in his Tshuva, relevant to our Gemara and Samachas, that maybe even some level of deception, in the case of Rav Yanai, might be justified if that's what we're talking about. So that was actually the first topic that we had spoken about the first day, just mentioning that fear exists and prompting that question. So now we've brought that full circle by getting back to Kfiyah on our topic and gotten us to the beginning of our Chazara. So maybe we'll just review what we said today and then we'll continue the full-blown Chazara tomorrow. So essentially what we see today, so we talked about the different possible levels of deception that could exist, that some are prohibited, most are prohibited, some might not be in terms of staka. We saw to misrepresent your anias is a problem for sure, and the Gemara says we're lucky to have the Ramayim, and we discussed the Tshuva Saber Yaakov, what exactly we're talking about, who's lucky, somebody wants to give staka, probably not, somebody doesn't want to give staka, why does it make a difference? And his suggestion that's not about staka, that the liars save you from any problems, but it's about the next thing the Gemara has, the Vamal Lemein of Nastaka is Kiilu Avra Vazara. And then we discussed that the fundraisers also are not allowed to lie. They're not allowed to lie about which staka it is, and they're not allowed to lie about how popular the staka is. That's what the Gemara in Sukkah seems to tell us about poskei staka of the rabbin. But we found, on the other hand, some sources that seem to allow some level of deception. Rav Yannai making the pile look smaller, and Yerushalmi about the Zachariah who collected, and he wasn't really poor, but he was collecting on behalf of other anim. So it seems like in those two cases, besides the fact they both have the endorsement of Shas Bavli or Yerushalmi, but they seem to be addressing a real cause just through different ways of getting people to give to the cause that they would otherwise justifiably be obligated in. But if the cause itself is deceptive, even in terms of its popularity, that's more of a problem. It's discussed basically with Zilberstein's case about pumping up a lottery for the purpose of staka, which he asked in the end. We thought that should be even more clearly lesser because you're selling the tickets under false pretenses, it seems. That's an additional level of deception. And then we talked about somebody who asks to be listed on a staka donor list. If this year they're not actually given, they've given in the past, and they don't want to be embarrassed, so you're allowed to go along with that. And we thought there was a strong case to be made that yes, because the Gnevus Das for the cause doesn't seem to be significant if it's one of many, and for the donor doesn't seem to be significant if they've established their willingness to do this when they can in the past few years, so it's not really false goodwill. And the idea of saving them from embarrassment, we've seen in Dei Mahsoro, that is a legitimate cause to try to help people not have to have this revealed, so all of that helps to make the case, and we made the opposite case a little bit, that maybe we should help them go down a level, and that's also the message of Dei Mahsoro, also a point to be considered. And then we discussed that another approach taken to these Gemaras is, as Rav Ozner writes in his Chuvas, that if it's a case of Kfiyah, so that could also justify it. So we talked about Kfiyah, the fact that the Gemara seems to say Kfiyah existed by Tzedakah, and we brought up various questions about how is this consistent with the goals of Tzedakah, with some of the variables of Tzedakah. I don't think we mentioned before the Vilna Gaon's Drasha and the Pasuk Lasikbo Tzitziyadka, that you shouldn't clench your fist, because when you clench your fist, it looks like all the fingers are the same size, but when you open it up, you see they're all different sizes, there's so many variables that we can't always predict from the outside, so all of this makes Kfiyah a difficult concept. But the Rishonim ask it from a more technical place, the fact that there is a Matan Tzchar B'Tzida, and the Gemara says in Mechulin that if there's a Matan Tzchar B'Tzida, that we don't use Kfiyah. So there are different approaches, either that here stuff that we have the Lavin, that's what makes the difference. So as we know, you have to say more than just the presence of the lavin, but that redefines the mitzvah into a category where all of a sudden kfiyah is more appropriate, or it's because of the shibud ben adam l'chavero, it's not because of the mitzvah, or it's because of the neder, and even if you don't actually make a neder, but it's the neder that is self-evident and imposed externally because of the general chiyuv. And we mentioned that a lot of the Rishonim, and Tosfos here, we won't pay so much attention to it, also mentions this answer that this isn't real kfiyah, but this is just kfiyah b'dvarim, which could account for the pressure we sometimes find. It's also a line of what Rav Ozner was talking about in terms of the slight methods of deception, and that the poskim maintain that kfiyah is shayach v'zman hazeh, although practically speaking it's not, because we don't have the structure, we don't have the mechanism to actually perform kfiyah, but we do have the possibility of doing it with words, and that might be the case. Just to give another mashal for this, and then we'll close, that there is a debate, fascinating topic, maybe we'll have an opportunity to talk about this in more length, but there are some Rishonim who say that a Beis Din can be kofa on a psak, that's just an psak, but also on the Fnim Mishur Sadin, and going beyond the law. So many other Rishonim found that very difficult, and Beis Yosef finds that difficult. It says, what's the difference then between din and the lefnim mishuras hadin? If bezdin can be kofa on it, so then that's the din. We can't call it the lefnim mishuras hadin if we're calling it so obligatory that bezdin will actually be kofa on it. So the Eger over there says that we're not talking about the fee in the normal sense. We don't mean the bezdin enforcing it in the full enforcement that it normally has. It means that they can call the guy a jerk. It means that they can essentially pressure him with words. So it's that different level of fear that some of the Rishonim are alluding to here that exists within the pantheon of different coercive measures that we find, different ways that society has in order to try to address its values to all of its inhabitants. Okay, so we'll stop there. We'll pick up with a full-blown Chazara tomorrow. Wish everyone a good day. Successful. Thank you for having me.